Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Vicky Hayward, I'm the chairman of the RSA, and as you can see, there was absolutely no interest at all in taking part in this evening's event. So as long as Nick and I don't fall off the stage, we should be able to get through the first few moments. Thank you so much for coming this evening to this fantastically well-supported event, Nations on the World Stage. Sometimes I am challenged as chairman of the RSA that the arts in our title is not always something that we're concentrating on. And I spend some of my time telling people that that certainly isn't true. And just this week alone has very much proved the point to me as I sat down and read the Gulbenkian report, which we are partners on the civic role of the arts, which is part one of a report that they're creating. And secondly, I was chairing our Learning About Culture project, which is an extraordinarily huge research project, which we are doing in collaboration with the Education Endowment Fund and the Arts Council and the Paul Hamlin Foundation. And it's really going to be an extremely interesting two-year research project on proving the value of creativity in education. And thirdly, this evening's event. Thank you very much to Mark for hosting this panel, and good luck. But it is my very great honour to be able to welcome Nick Sirota to the stage. I think this is your first official event as chairman of the Arts Council at the RSA. And it gives me the opportunity to both congratulate you on your appointment, but also to thank you for putting up your hand for what is such an important job for us in the arts today. You hold in your arms the whole of the aspirations of the arts community, and you know that you do. And you also know, I think, that we have enormous faith in you, Nick, as chairman of the Arts Council, and a huge gratitude. And thank you very much for taking on that role, because it's very important, and particularly important in this changing world. Thank you very much.
Vicky, ladies and gentlemen, there's no pressure then, Vicky, I understand. You said it's a changing world, and of course, if you look across the world today, one has to be very conscious that the actions of nations, and indeed the actions of individuals, are very much governed by the notions of interdependence rather than independence. And that makes life much, much more difficult. And if you look at the result of the referendum, it seems to me that it suggests that there was here, or is here, a certain yearning for a stability, a certain wish to not so much withdraw from the world, because of course we're told all the time that we must look out, and indeed we do look out, but rather more just for a set of values that are perhaps less frequently challenged than some of the values have been in recent years. Brexit is an economic issue, it's a political issue, but it's very much also a personal, a social, and a psychological question. And that's why I think it's so important that we're here today, because the theatre is incredibly well placed to open up some of those questions for discussion and debate. And this collaboration between four theatres in four nations strikes me as being a really, it's not only original in its form, but it's also, I hope, is going to shed new light from the point of view of new writing, and different perspectives. So we at the Arts Council are really thrilled that this is happening. I do want to thank the RSA for hosting this evening, and Vicky says that occasionally the RSA is perhaps accused of not doing enough in the field of the arts, but frankly this kind of event is a really big contribution. And I do want to thank also James Dacre for inviting me to come this evening, but also in a way for initiating this whole program. So, Mark, over to you, and I look forward to the evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. So there are three parts to this evening. At the end of all this, James Dacre and David Gregg will announce a cycle of plays that will look at all parts of the Great Britain up to roughly 2027. We're going to have a debate between these seven playwrights for a while, and then we'll open it up to you, and there'll be microphones out in the audience. When we get to that bit, can I just ask, as I always do on these occasions, no matter how famous you may think you are in the arts world, if you could just tell us who you are so that people who might have missed out on you for some reason know what perspective you're coming from. The topic for tonight is how should theatre respond to and reflect the changing role of Great Britain, Northern Ireland and Europe over the next decade? So the length of time is important. They were going beyond 2019. We're going up to a period when Sixtus Rees-Mogg, currently a baby, may be leader of the Young Conservatives by the time this cycle is over. Playwrights are used to attracting a starry cast to their work, but this is a starry cast of playwrights. I'll introduce seven, and then they'll make a brief statement, a short speech, each of them, and then we'll knock a few things around, and then we'll open it up to you. Brad Birch, his plays include Permafrost and The Brink, and he was the recipient last year of the Harold Pinter Commission to write a new play for the Royal Court. Tanika Gupta, her plays include Sanctuary, Sugar Mummies, and her adaptation recently, Anita and Me, which I saw in Birmingham and was tremendous, as indeed is all the work represented here, pretty much. Because I know how competitive playwrights are, so it's just a matter of different brilliances among the seven people on the panel. James Graham, who will blush, but he is, I believe, the first writer since Alan Ayckbourn to have two new plays in adjoining West End theatres. At different points in St. Martin's Lane at the moment, you can see Ink by James and Labour of Love by James, theatres next door to each other. The subject matter of the plays and producing a rare example of Rupert Murdoch and Jeremy Corbyn being side by side. Next year, this house goes on tour, and in November, quiz about a coughing major, alleged coughing major, we have to say, don't we, James, incident on TV opens at Chichester. Then April De Angelis, plays include Breathless, Hush, The Positive Hour, Jumpy, which is a great role for Tamsin Gregg, and James has got another great role for Tamsin Gregg in Labour of Love. Roy Williams, his plays include Sing Your Heart Out for the Lads, in my personal view, the best play ever written about football, Sucker Punch, one of the best plays ever written about boxing, and Fallout, which I don't know, I'm not going to rank that one, but anyway, that was a great play about British society at the time. And then we have Rosemary Jenkinson, whose plays include Planet Belfast, which gives you a sense of where she comes from, Stella Morgan, and Love or Money.
Have you seen them?
I have seen one of your plays, yes. I saw Planet Belfast, amazingly, while I was in Planet Belfast. So
there you go.
So there you are. Good stuff. And then Kwame Kwe Armah, this is nostalgic for me. We spent many nights broadcasting on TV in the past. His plays include a trilogy at the National Theatre, Elmina's Kitchen, Fix Up, and Statement of Regret. He is currently Artistic Director of Centre Stage in Baltimore, and directing as well at the moment, One Night in Miami, another great play about boxing, actually, although not as good as Roy's, obviously, was at the... he directed at the Donmar, and currently directing a new version, modernisation of Ibsen's The Lady from the Sea. So, opening statements, please. We didn't draw lots. Well, basically, I told Roy he had to go first. Yeah. So, Roy, if you could go first, please.
How theatre should respond to and reflect the changing role of Britain in Europe over the next decade is by presenting itself in its most honest and truest form. I believe that by telling a good story first and foremost, secondly, by celebrating as well as questioning what it means to live a life, all of our lives, not the select few and that some feel is more worthy or more important than others, all of our lives, British lives, European lives, worldwide lives. Not one society, not one race or any creed should be overlooked. We find each other's flaws. We debate our flaws. We question our flaws. We argue against each other's flaws. We share our flaws. We learn from our flaws. We do so also by opening our windows and taking a good long look at what Britain looks like now. Not what some may want it to look like or how it used to look like before, but how it looks like now. Not just on the surface or even in depth, but also, and perhaps more importantly, between the cracks. Because that is what makes us all human, the cracks. Otherwise, I will continue to know who theatre in this country is for, but not what it's for.
Thank you very much, Roy. And second statement, please, from Tanika Gupta.
I would like to start by saying, rather than looking ahead, I'd like to look at what's been happening up until now and how we can change that so that we do move forward. And my big problem with theatre, even though I work in it, is it is monocultural and extremely Eurocentric. And I think the stories that are out there are not getting told, you know, the stories of a diverse community are not getting told on our major stages. I think that some of the national theatres have failed abysmally to actually include people. And when I say include, I mean I'm talking about writers and actors and and directors. So that we do have, we still have one story being told without taking away from any of the brilliance of the stories that are there out there. I would like to pose the question so that we can look forward to actually asking who is holding the pen, who are writing the stories, and whose stories are being told. And at the moment, it doesn't feel like enough diversity or what we should term as inclusivity is being involved in the theatre generally. And I would really like to see a world in the future in Britain, in UK, and in Europe, where we actually tell everybody's stories and not just one strand.
Thank you very much. And the third speaker is, where are you? There you are, Rosemary Jenkinson. Thank you.
So first the big divorce, then we leave the single market to go on the singles market. But what happens to the kids? What about the problem child of Northern Ireland? Unloved by England and Ireland, but still coveted by both. Are we prepared for the breakup of the Union? Northern Ireland voted mainly to stay in Europe, so Irish nationalism is being reignited under the guise of Europhilia. So one question for theatre is, how do we playwrights respond rapidly to Brexit? When it's the great unpredictable unknown, do we risk looking stupid if we write plays with doomsday scenarios that never transpire? But the main question for theatre is, are we keen on raising the ugly head of nationalism that has been contained for the past 20 years by the peace process? I've got used to skipping back and forth across the Irish border without a thought in the world. Am I, as a Northern Irish writer, ready to write according to my tribal lines? I'm a Protestant, but I haven't been forced to pick a side in years, and it's been wonderful not to be labelled. For us, the huge challenge of Brexit is how to respond without putting theatre and politics back years. Brexit means either Northern Ireland is strengthened in its Britishness by an economy that splits partially from the South, or Northern Ireland is inspired by Irish nationalism to break from the Union and join Ireland in the EU. Either way, theatre has to respond by imagining the future violence that might ensue. But can we do this without religious bias? The last thing we want is to be unionist or nationalist playwrights.
Thank you very much. James Graham.
I'm really inspired already by some of the answers that people are suggesting. I only have questions and I feel incredibly lost most of the time. I think as a writer who tries to or pretends to respond to events, I think the main challenge often is how the hell you keep up with events that seem to spiral so quickly out of control. But I think the problems or the challenges facing theatre are the ones facing politics at the moment. If you look at how language has changed in our political discourse over the past few years, words like open and free and community are being replaced by words like closed and protection, and even the bill that go through Parliament at the moment, the word is withdrawal, and there's something about that word, regardless of whether you voted leave or remain, whether you want to stay or whether you want to go. There's something about that word which really scares me and feels really defeatist. The idea of withdrawing from something is not what feels like theatre should be. It feels like theatre should connect and engage and look at something in the eye. I think we're facing challenges as a world and a community anyway in the way that art is being made and digested. It's becoming increasingly more private and atomised. Even things that used to be collective, like watching a movie in a cinema or watching a TV drama with your family around one television rather than six different screens and each family member in a different room. So theatre, for me, and it sounds probably overly romantic and overly sentimental, but it's one of the last remaining forums to get a community of people together and explore an idea that can be complex and nuanced and even disconcerting and challenging to you outside of your bubble, the bubble of your feed where you block ideas that you don't enjoy. I feel that that is a challenge because that's not the way that conversation and discourse is going. It's becoming more restricted and becoming more closed, and theatre is all about being open. But I think it presents an opportunity and a responsibility to somehow drag ourselves out of whatever that word bubble means, whether it means your political bubble, whether it means your geographical bubble, your community, and into a space where uncomfortable and difficult ideas can hopefully be discussed with a word I sort of treasure, but I think is often frowned upon in theatre, which is balance and nuance and living in the grey. So that's what I'm going to aspire to do, but you're going to tell me how to do that because I've got no idea.
Thank you very much. April D'Angelis.
Brexit. How is theatre going to respond to Brexit? From my perspective, Brexit isn't so much going to that's going to have forward-going implications, which it is, but I'd rather look at it as a symptom, and a symptom of what's been happening in Britain in terms of monetarism and in terms of governments since 1979 that have been basically, government's been a mechanism for taking wealth from everybody and stripping it and giving it to a minority. And that, so in a sense, theatre, what is the point of theatre if it's not for everybody? What is the point of theatre if it's for a minority? How can you sit here and argue that theatre is important when some people can't feed their children? I don't want to do that. I want to live in a world where people can afford to feed their children, where we're not having a government that robs us and for the few. I want 30 years ago, a CEO of a company earned 20 times that of an average worker. Today, he or she earns 150 times, and that's figures from Jeremy Corbyn, so thank you, Jeremy. I want theatre, the challenge for playwrights is how do we address that inequality? And it's not a new question, it's a question that's been with us since 1979.
Thank you, Brad Bird.
How should theatre respond to? I struggle with the question. I struggle with should and art. I think that's not a good word because it makes it feel like school. So I think how can theatre respond is a slightly better question for me to.
Well, you could ask should theatre respond.
Should theatre respond at all? Yeah. But I think So maybe we'll come to that. how can theatre respond? I think we need to do something a bit different than describing what's happening. We were told really clearly what was definitely going to happen before the referendum, and then after the referendum we were told exactly why it didn't happen. I think we need to avoid punditry, and I think that the gesture of art can offer something a bit different. And I think I find inspiration in the medium of the fragrance advert. I find them fascinating. I kind of love them. Because the one thing they very can't do is just tell you what the thing smells like. So what they have to do instead is they have to use symbol and metaphor and language and different ways of trying to evoke the feeling that you will feel when you smell that fragrance. So the question for me is, what does Brexit smell like? And I think if we can look at trying to crack that, what is the feeling of Brexit? What brought us here and where is it taking us? Without having to mention Michael Gove, that would be my kind of where I'm aiming towards.
Thank you very much. So I'd like to start with that, the smell of Brexit, because... Kwame, God, I've gone... I'm so sorry. God, yes. Kwame.
You got away with it.
I almost did. It's because I couldn't read my handwriting, and I thought you were going... Yeah,
no
I'm
worries.
Really sorry, Kwame.
No worries at all. I think the challenge of Brexit for theatre in an increasingly borderless world is do we want what Nick said? Do we want interdependence? I think that theatre in Britain has practiced Brexit for as long as I can remember. I think we privilege the English word. We even take the Scandinavian stuff and kind of nice it up and make it really English, so we actually think that Ibsen is from Northampton. And I think the big question for me is actually, do we care? It's all with our nice, liberal, progressive sensibilities that we think that most of us artists are until we crack our first couple of million and have to pay a lot of tax. Do we actually care? The privileging of the English language, we think about internationalism invariably through the lens of, well, there's this British new play, and there's this English new play, and there's this Irish new play, and then there's this American new play, and then there's this Scandinavian that really looks like British. And I'm really interested in how we integrate with Europe on this plays that we actually put on our stages, on the plays that we commission, and how we approach it in a way that actually opera does. Opera's not afraid of internationalism. It's not afraid of language. And I think we are. What do we do about that?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? Because obviously opera, I mean, just down the road, English National Opera is, they're translated into English, surtitles. Because language is the key thing in theatre, isn't it? That we have always translated the plays. Some are done with surtitles. But is that what you're suggesting? Keep them in the original language.
I don't know. I'd be interested in the experiment. I know that the best Julius Caesar I ever saw was in Milan. I don't speak Italian. And, of course, I knew the plot. But the production was magnificent, and I was in it every beat of the way. And I don't know if I could see that production other than in a presenting house rather than a producing house.
Okay, seven tremendous opening statements. I thought we're being streamed online as well, so we've got a large audience beyond. We'll talk for a bit and then we'll take questions from the audience. Picking up on Brad's point about the smell of Brexit and James's point about balance and nuance, this seems to be crucial because Brexit smells differently to some people, even in the cabinet. To some people it smells fragrant, and to other people it smells noxious and unpleasant. This is the second great debate about Brexit today. There was a cabinet meeting this morning that apparently lasted several hours and was very argumentative. So we're going to aim for something that is half the length and twice as disputatious, please, from the panel. But that question of balance, because... certainly on the day of the referendum, 52-48, we suspect, although I don't have a survey to hand, but we suspect that in the theatre world, maybe rather more than 48% pro-European. So can we talk about how we handle that? Do you, should any season of plays be 48-52 balance? Should any play be 42-58 balance? 48-52. How do you do that? To what extent, this seems to be a big question, to what extent are you prepared to disagree with people in the audience or have people in the audience disagreeing with you, James?
God.
Yeah.
I suppose it's almost to Tanika's point. It's about actually finding those voices. I mean, you can fake it yourself. You can be a Remain voter and pretend to walk in the shoes of a Leave voter and try and write that play. Or I guess you can just name the debate and have the debate between characters on the stage. I'm just on a play about Rupert Murdoch where. I took the decision to not necessarily string him up and hold him to account in the way that I think other playwrights necessarily would, and I really want to see that other version of that play. I have to admit, it was sort of thrilling to be at the Almeida in Islington and watch lots of Guardian readers come out going, "Oh God, I think I like him," and then and then me thinking, "Oh God, I've gone too far the other way," and having to pull it back. But it's a lot of these issues to do with Brexit, as April has said, are incredibly serious and. I don't think balance means compromise. I don't think balance means wooliness or toothlessness. I relish finding territory that embraces all the contradictions, and I also agree with what Brad said. I don't think theatre is journalism, and nor should it be. I don't think it's a list of facts and a chronology of events. I think, for me, the power of theatre, and particularly political theatre, has always been narrative and metaphor. I think the best political play ever is not... Arthur Miller could have done a verbatim play about the McCarthy trials 2 weeks after it happened, and actually he didn't. He waited a couple of years and did what I think is the best political allegory of all time in the form of The Crucible. So my get-out clause is saying I'm not going to touch it for 3 years. I'm going to wait and see what it means, because I don't think you can know what something means until it's run its course.
April, on that, to what extent balance in plays about Brexit and post-Brexit, so we're looking 10 years ahead. I mean, the talks may still be going on in 10 years, who knows? But that's,
Well, I don't think balance is a very... I mean, I always find that word really weird. It's like if you were writing a play about Nazi Germany, would you write balance between Hitler and sort of, you know, the Jewish population? You wouldn't. There isn't balance, but you do look for conflict, and you do place, as a playwright, you would place your conflict in provocative and challenging ways, and hopefully there wouldn't be easy answers. So, you know, for example, looking at Brexit, you know, the stupid people that voted for Brexit, working class people, probably, that connection's sort of been made. I mean, are they stupid? Are they really angry? And how...
Are you saying they were stupid?
No, I think they were... I think they were... There's a mythology. There's a mythology that they bought into about nationalism wasn't politicised, so I'd say that. I don't think that's stupid. I think, you know, we all fall for mythologies, don't we? One of them being that working class people are stupid, perhaps that's a mythology. But anyway, to get to my point, you know, you want to provoke and challenge and overturn and make people look at themselves and not make people feel complacent. So that, and I think if that's what theatre does. I don't know if that's what balance quite has to do with that.
But the stupid people who voted for Brexit, that would be a provocative title for a play.
Well, of course it would, but if you just delivered that very simply, then it would be a really boring play, wouldn't it?
Kwame, I think it's Michael Frayn, it was, who said that in a good play, every character is right, didn't he? Lots of playwrights have said versions of that.
That's exactly where I was going, so I don't need to say it.
No, go on.
I was going to say that ultimately I think our job as playwrights is to love every character that we put on the page. And so I think that our challenge is that we have to seek balance. James Baldwin, in his play Blues for Mr. Charlie, taught me something about white supremacy in a way that allowed me to have empathy for it. In that play, a young man from the South goes up north and he gets ideas about civil rights and he brings it back to the South, and this white supremacist kills him. And in the last scene, or penultimate scene, when the guy's asked why he killed the young man, he says, because I'm a parent. And as a parent, we want our children to inherit more than we do. And what kind of man would I be, what kind of father would I be, if I allowed my child to inherit less because I took the demands of this northern agitator? My children would inherit less. And I know what that did for me in terms of the way that I looked at the white majority and structural racism and structural inequality. It allowed me to take a look at it through the lens of what do they feel that they are losing. And so I ultimately feel that it's our job to have balance and to love every character and to also have a point of view that we're willing to defend. I think we can have both objectivity and subjectivity. That's our gig.
Rosemary, that Chinese proverb, much quoted, may live in interesting times. You have that in Northern Ireland at the moment. The future of the current government depends on Northern Ireland. The future of the outcome of the Brexit talks almost certainly depends on Northern Ireland. It's one of the three red lines. But you mentioned in your talk that balance in a Northern Irish context, as the BBC have discovered over the decades, is a hugely complex, because neither side will accept that it is balanced.
Yeah, well, that's really the thing. I was just saying that you are put very much in a position where you have to take one side. I mean, it's so divided, sort of, and even like, you know, our population between Protestant and Catholic are so equal now, and it's just like, you just feel like you have to go one way, make a decision to go one way, and it's very difficult. But as I say, I kind of welcome, as a playwright, interesting times. So I have to say that it is great, actually, that London is paying us attention and on this. I mean, they actually are Googling the DUP. Their website crashed. I mean, they can't even believe this. So it's good to be in the news, not for the best things, but at least we're not being ignored.
We may not bring in everyone on every round, but we'll see. Anyone want to say anything on this? The question of balance and...
There was a meeting that we all went to as playwrights some time ago, where a Tory minister accused us all of... He actually said, why do none of you write right-wing plays? And we all kind of looked at each other, and we could think of one person, but I won't mention him for libel. But
it was interesting. He was
just
he was it? Richard Bean.
No, it wasn't Richard Bean. anyway, so then he accused Lucy Prebble of writing an anti-capitalist play, and we all kind of like sat around and kind of looked at each other and thought, we just write plays. We don't necessarily think that we're left-wing. We're presenting a world, but actually, to him, he felt that we were all left-wingers and Marxists, and we were all knocking the Tory government, and this was around the time of Brexit as well. And I think that certainly, I think as a playwright, you never think of writing balanced plays. For myself, when I come out and see people vomiting or crying or shouting in the toilets, I'm delighted because I've had some sort of reaction. And also that whole thing that we're talking about, that you're presenting human beings, and it's like, you know, you can have a family where somebody's voted Brexit and the others haven't, and everyone's shouting at each other. That's conflict, that's drama. Doesn't mean that you absolutely hate each other till the end of the days, but it's quite, it is a very difficult time at the moment in terms of those sort of viewpoints.
Right.
No, just to add to that, I remember when... obviously, the march against the war in Iraq in 2003 and then subsequent dramas sort of came from that. And it came to a point when I just thought, if I see one more play about, oh, Tony Blair lied, George Bush lied, I would scream. I almost want to give me a play that dares me to, you know, support the war. Not that I would in a million years, but I wanted some drama, some fiction that would dare me to do that. And so, yeah, I mean, the words we've been saying about... what was he said?
I don't know. So it went in and went out.
Oh. balance. That's it. Balance. Yes, that's all. But also, like I said in my introduction, it's about the cracks, going in between, and also to pick up on what Tanika said. It's I'm not looking for a balanced play that sort of says that. I just I want to be surprised when I see a theatre piece. And also, I want it to, in spite of the beliefs I may have about Brexit or whatever, and I do have views about Brexit, but I think what will make the world very interesting is, but see it from this point of view. And in a way, I think that makes us all liberal in a weird way, whether you like it or not, by inviting that question in the first place.
I was very struck by that, because the Edinburgh Festival this year, I saw five satires about Donald Trump in a row on the same day, and every single play took the same attitude towards Trump. Everyone in the audience thought the same thing, and I thought, like you, well, could we see one that defends him?
He's an arsehole, we know that. He's a, he's a card-carrying dickhead.
Can I just add a caveat to that as well? I think it's a really clever way of trying to get in on our patch a little bit as well. That if we look... I completely understand around understanding and empathy, and but if we look at the wider culture, there aren't many areas of the left and of the liberal. If we look at what's in the news every day, the way in which things are framed, the way in which the newspapers run amok, and now they're telling us that our and also the Theatre of Julian Fellowes isn't the theatre of the left either. So we don't, we don't own this space.
But Julian Fellowes was the right-wing... that's
interesting. So you also just say the theatre is the balance to the newspaper.
No, I don't think we've come anywhere near being a balance. I think we're a drop in the ocean. But I think, though I completely take all those points and I completely agree as well, I just think a slight caveat of let's not get carried away and trying to, kind of lose actually an intellectual space.
And I'd like to support that in an odd way, because I think when we write our plays, and particularly when they're published, these are acts of history, that you go back and you look at a time and you go, oh, that's what was happening in the nuances, in the cracks. This was a view, and invariably history leans to the right. And so to find documents that actually speak, and it doesn't even have to speak from the left, but just doesn't support a right-leaning status quo agenda, actually is tremendously important. And I think it's very important for us as artists to remember that these are historical documents.
But one of the strangest and most interesting atmospheres I've ever experienced in a theatre was in Stuff Happens, David Hare of the National Theatre. There's that one speech where a journalist defends the, reputedly based on Nick Cohen, The Observer, defends the Iraq War. And the resentment and horror in the audience of the Olivier was a spectacular thing to behold. So sometimes the audience will resist any attempt to tell them something they don't agree with.
Yeah, exactly. And I definitely, you'll find a playwright. I'm pretty certain David Hare is very. I mean, I remember I was in a meeting with him, a function. I think, were you there as well, Tanika?
I think that was the same meeting.
That was the same, yeah.
Yes, when he started jabbing.
Where he and Julian Fellowes just absolutely just, you know, went at each other for obvious reasons. Yeah. So it's just interesting that, you know, a playwright like David Hare would write that speech.
And we were all sitting there thinking this would make a great two-hander. Yeah.
The next subject I want to discuss before we open it up is, which came up, is the question of keeping up with events. We're in a situation, this cycle of plays is going to look ahead a decade. You'd have to be fairly brave to bet who will be Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary by Saturday. So how do you write plays in that context? Again, I saw, it was very funny, I saw a production in Edinburgh called Brexit, the musical, but it was about, the jokes were about a year out of date. They were about Andrew Leadsom loving children and all this kind of stuff, and all this other stuff had happened. So this is the problem, that history, well, news will not stay still. That's the problem. How do you deal with that? Who would like to?
Metaphor.
Mm.
I mean, that's the key for me anyway. I know certainly as a political playwright, certainly in my early days, I just wanted to get my view across. As I've moved into directing a bit, metaphor is the great tool. And it's also, it gives you plausible deniability as well, if you need it at any moment. But I think finding the metaphor is the key to keeping up with events, because you can't, you know, particularly in America where I live at the moment, you know, every day as we all know, there's a new tweet that's going in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And if you try to keep, and if you try and create a narrative around even understanding why tweet one was different from tweet two, you're lost, or you're just going into the land of being a pundit and you want to be on TV just talking. So I think, to repeat myself, I think the challenge is finding the metaphor, finding the historical works that speak to the time and the era, if not specificity.
All parallels. I can ask you, James, that, because we worry about political plays being overtaken by events. They can be taken up by events. You had this with This House, where the first run of it coincided with a minority government, and then, well, we don't know. I mean, who knows what the government will be when it comes back next year and goes on to it. But so it's interesting. So it's both historical and topical, This House.
Yes, well, I had no idea when I wrote a play about minority governments that it would prove so lucrative. I thought it was going to be absolutely only 12 people were going to go and see it, and it would never be relevant again. But I entirely agree with Kwame, actually, and I was going to say it's not a trick. I mean, Shakespeare did it and the Greeks did it, but for me it's just useful to use history to go back to the past and find equivalent events to make sense of what's happening now, and just by definition or by default, that provides a historical context and a longer lens view of what's happening, so you don't have to worry about keeping up with contemporary events. That's why we still do it. That's why we still, when, you know, in any war, any conflict, any fall of a leader, we still revert back to some of those 500, 1,000-year-old plays, because they have the durability and the broadness to their scope that just speaks to what it is to be human and to try and organise your society in a different way and probably fail. Also, I was researching Brexit and the campaign for a particular project, and it was, I forget, somebody in the Remain campaign said to me, they tried to describe the moment they realised that they'd been duped into holding the referendum in the way that it felt like two people of equal sides coming to a shootout and going, let's have this referendum. We'll have 6 weeks and it'll be an equal campaign. And the Remain side went, great, okay, cool. And the moment they realised about 3 weeks into the campaign that it didn't start 6 weeks ago, it started 25 years ago. Mm. And the Leave side had been fighting this for 25 years, and then they pretended to start 6 weeks ago. And just the way the Remain campaign is reminded me that if you want to tackle Brexit is not necessarily to write the Michael Gove play. These fault lines began way, 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 way back in our history, and it's about Britain, it's about this country. And so you could pick any moment, I think, since the 1950s, and it would speak to Brexit.
But also the practice of the political types and the political tactics are so unchanged. I mean, that's why Julius Caesar, I mean, they did a specific Trump production in America, but Gore Vidal's The Best Man is about to revive, written in 1960, but one of the characters is a crazed southern populist who clearly they're going to make a connection with somebody with a home in the south, his Florida home. Waste, Harley Granville Barker, which is about a bill to establish the Church of England. But again, all those types are still recognisable in politics, although they tend, but this is true in politics, I mean, they tend to be men very largely. But a play can find its moment, even if not written for it.
I mean, I have to say that I've just finished... I had a show on the Globe that just finished on Saturday, and that was a historical play, and it was actually based on my great uncle, who was a freedom fighter in India. And because it's 70 years since Indian independence this year, the play finally went on after 20 years of trying to get the damn thing on. And basically what happens, my 19-year-old great uncle broke into Writers' Building in Calcutta, shot and killed the Inspector General of Prisons, and then shot himself, but it didn't manage to kill himself. And the Brits took the bullet out, and then 6 months later they hanged him. And so the play was about him, basically, and about the fight for freedom and independence. But actually what ended up happening was the play ended up being about the young and the old. Basically, my great uncle says in one of his letters from prison, nobody over the age of 60 should be allowed to vote because they get it wrong and they don't understand young people. And this is back in 1930. And so it's that same thing about metaphor. It's about you put a play on which is historical and actually just speaks to everybody now. These boys were freedom fighters, as in they were Hindu and they believed in armed insurrection, which is not very different to what's going on at the moment, but they were not Muslims. And the Brits were fighting them all the way, failing in many cases. So it's a really interesting thing as a playwright to write plays which are about today but use the past. And I think that, you know, given what's going on, it feels like the whole world has gone inside out. I mean, there's Brexit, Brexit isn't just the only thing. There's Trump, then there's Emma Rice losing artistic directorship of the Globe. It's all these kind of strange things that are happening. Where do you start? And you can only start from your own stories, I think, and what inspires you as a writer.
And before we open it up to the audience, something which Kwame mentioned at the beginning, I think Tanika did, is the range of voices, diversity. So these plays on this subject, Britain in the next 10 years, should they be necessarily written in English? Where should they come from? How wide should the spectrum be?
I'm really interested in the German playwright that wants to write a play about what they feel about Britain and how they've felt about Britain since we've been in the EU and since Margaret Thatcher. I'm really interested in the French playwright who looks at what's happened at Calais and what the effect of that. I'm really interested in hearing the Polish playwright and their attitude to ethnic minorities in other countries. I think I find myself fascinated by how we, as playwrights and as artists, find other people across the continent to echo, to play with, to write with, to not just, I mean, again, playwriting is often perceived as it's this solo thing. And do we want to break that form and find someone else and do it in a different fashion? Because we are in a different time. We are in an instant My Story Instagram time. And are we finding ourselves using 19th and 20th century techniques when actually what the calling I feel for my children is, if I want to validate being a playwright, is how am I speaking to the here and now and how am I changing the form?
But if those, as I mentioned earlier, if those, for example, those German and French hypothetical plays, should they then be given to Christopher Hampton or someone to mediate for an English audience, or should you try to present them in French or German?
I mean, you know, there are foreign movies, right? Mm. I mean, you know, I absolutely think that it's up to the artistic director to work out his or her audience and whether they have a tolerance to sit there and read surtitles or whether it's mixed and it's in English and it's in the original language. I don't know. But I certainly think that the prism that we find ourselves in, which only privileges English, particularly when we're speaking about internationalism, is problematic. And the next generation below us don't view the world in exactly the same way. And if we don't do anything, even talking amongst ourselves primarily about the English take or the British take on Brexit, seems insular and 20th century.
Anyone else pick up?
Well,
on
one thing I would pick up on is, I mean, you can talk, you know, what about diversity within British writing? I mean, we've talked about having voices, not just having a white voice, but also what about, and obviously wanting a woman's voices, but also class. I mean, there's been a big lot of stuff in the papers recently about the fact that you know, working class people cannot go to drama school. Now, there's a real link between being an actor and being a writer, and I got Harold Pinter being a famous one. I was once an actor, I'm sure. Kwame was an actor. Do you know what I mean? So once you were, okay, so look, on this, so you're...
Just interestingly, how many of the playwrights didn't start as an actor? You weren't an actor, were you, James?
Not a paid one.
I'm not sure that defines...
Yeah, that's really good point.
Or not.
Rosemary, were you? No. Okay, sorry, go on.
But I mean, that's just one little kind of example of how the fact that you're just going to get a narrower group of people being able to work in the theatre, getting into, you know, economically, the voices are going to be less. And so you're not even going to have diversity. Talk about a debate about Brexit. Well, you're wiping away the people that actually you might want to hear from. So that's another kind of form of diversity that we, you know, but unless things change, we're not going to have those voices. You say goodbye to Andrew Dunbar's of this world.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned at all the wider context of this, which is that we have the head of the Arts Council here. You'd have to put your tin hat on as a subsidised theatre if you commissioned a French play about Brexit, say, and put it on, because certain politicians, certain journalists would get quite aerated about it, wouldn't they? So, not to say it shouldn't happen, but you'd have to be ready for that as a theatre.
Yes. But then what are we doing?
Yes.
I mean, I don't think anyone here sat down and looked at the tyranny of the blank page and said, guess what, I'm going to worry about what critic or what, and you know, you just can't. You've got to shut that out and you've got to be true to what you feel. And I'm absolutely certain that there are many artistic directors who will say, in a mixed environment, in a season of 6 or 8 plays, can I afford to do that? Well, possibly. And then I'll put on an American musical next to make up for the deficit. I mean, who, you know, I absolutely think that you can.
I think we could be talking about anything and there'll be a diversity problem with the people writing the plays, I think. I think there's an odd parallel with the Brexit debate and how white and male it was. I think we're maybe slightly getting better. We're at least talking about it now. But I think class is a big one. I think Leave voters, right? I mean, we could ask Julian Fellowes. But I think we have a real problem because I certainly struggle with authenticity when trying to write about, say, somebody of the right, whether I have. I have the right. No. So it seems a very remainy establishment thing to start adopting other people's positions and then arguing against it
and putting these shows on in buildings with Royal in the title, I think we do have a problem. And if there can be positives from something like the political situation we're in, maybe we start looking at the structures, and that would be useful, I think.
Just before we open up to the audience, I promised the organiser I'd mention this last, because it's a personal obsession of mine, but they thought everyone would fall asleep, which is the effect of the Fixed-Term Parliament Act on political playwriting, of which James is a beneficiary, because for the first time in 2015... theatres knew when the election would be, which they never previously had. It had always been, and so the vote was Josie Rourke and James were able to do the Donmar. That's gone again now. We simply again don't know when the next election might be. I mean, it might be Tuesday, the way things are going, but you never know. So that does make political playwriting harder. Or does it?
I don't know. Probably not. Only if you wanted to do a stupid thing like do a play about the general election on the Election Act, which is what we did in 2015, and it was the only time we did it, because it was the only time we could ever do that, because we could plan 2 years in advance, and like you say, we can't do that now. Mm. No, I think I'm less worried about that. I think the questions we're asking are bigger and broader and require a longer lens than responding to events in that way.
Okay, we're moving towards the announcements, so... I don't know if we can bring the light, we can see you anyway. So we've got a couple of microphones out there. If you'd like, someone on this side, we have all the lights up. Anyone on that side like to wave for a microphone? Don't be shy, please. Anyone in the middle? Yes. Getting microphone round. As I say, even if you think you need no introduction, please do introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Yasmin Sidwar. I'm Artistic Director of Mandala Theatre Company. And I suppose I want to throw the question to you, is theatre within Brexit or without Brexit relevant? Because half the people that we're talking about who possibly voted to leave can't afford to go to the theatre. So it's a much bigger thing. I've been in theatre all my life, 25, 30 years, but I feel it's even harder to get other voices to even listen to anything in theatre, because it's not in school, it's not valued in school, people don't see their stories on stage. So is it a dying art for the privileged? And I would hate to think that, because I spend every day focused on it, but I do think it's a question we've got to talk about.
Who would like to take that on? Rosemary.
Yeah, it is definitely for the privileged, but I think for Brexit, I think we've got to imagine much more different things. Like, I think we could have a play in Northern Ireland on the border, and actually have it on the border and at the most important parts of the land. That I just think we can make big, bold statements with theatre in Brexit.
Although, depending on the outcome of the Brexit talks, half the audience might need visas to get in to see to see the play.
Yeah, great.
Right. Yeah.
Makes it harder, yeah, which is actually better in a way, yes.
I think, to answer your question, I think what we've got to do is kind of almost like what my English teacher, Mr. McKenna, did for me when I was 14. He threw a play at me, and it was Class Scenery by Nigel Williams, and he just said, read that. And I read it, and what jumped at me, I just thought, oh my God, this is about me. This is about me, my friends, and at school. And I just remember being so excited and so elated. So the whole notion of theatre at the time, when I thought that was for the privileged, was not back. And I just feel, yes, in spite of, yes, theatre's charging the earth for tickets, which is, you know, problematic and needs to be dealt with. But ultimately, you know, artists like us, we need to do just that. You know, if they don't come to us, fine, then we'll go to them, go to the schools, and share. This is why I love theatre.
Kwame Dan James,
This is an issue, of course, is that people of colour have faced for time immemorial, and that invariably it is perceived that you're writing this narrative from your cultural lens, and invariably the audience will be majority white. And also you have to do translation for that. But here's the plus side, particularly for political playwrights, is that if you write a play about a circumstance that is being played to the people who can change the circumstance, you have done service. You have been in service. And I think that's the lie, if it is a lie, that I give myself, that I go, you know, there are circumstances that that many, in terms of class and race, have to and gender, have to supersede. And I'm putting that play on in front of the people who can change the circumstances. And for me, that's phenomenally important.
James.
No, I couldn't agree more. I feel that very strongly with my own attempts at that, however successful or not. I was just going to fly a flag, as Roy did for education. It was, for me, it was that I went to a comprehensive school in a working class area in the town that was the seventh highest leave vote. I wouldn't be here without my teacher. It was education is the equalising effect, and I think that is, I have a bit of a personal problem with the EBAC. We can argue about that in a different debate, but how you prioritise that. I was also just going to question or provoke the idea, though, that this idea that people keep saying that the Leave vote is a right-wing vote. There are left-wing Leave voters. There's a Lexit, which sounds like a really bad club in Leeds. There's also, it's not all working class. Actually, it's not all poor. There is, you know, I know lots of Labour lords who voted to. I don't know them. They're not my mates, but I know of them. Who voted to leave. So it's
the Labour Party leader is quite equivocal about.
I mean, discuss.
Yeah. As discussed in Labour and Love, I would imagine.
Tickets available for £10, actually.
Yes.
there you go.
Anyone on this side? Please don't be shy. We've got time for a few more. Yes, there's one there. We get round there, and then if we get one round to on this side as well, then we'll do both. Yeah, thank you.
Daniel Buckroyd, Artistic Director of the Mercury Theatre in Colchester. Just a thought, we were talking about trying to get a long lens on this because it's moving so fast, and all of the comments were about pulling back into the past and the other opportunity is to project into the future. We've got a new play that we're producing next year which imagines just over the horizon, 5 years ahead, and looks back on what we're at now. Is anyone else looking to the future?
Anyone? Yes, because you could indeed write about the future of the Irish border.
I think writing about the future is great. I know I've done that many times with Planet Belfast. I was imagining about politics in the future, and it wasn't current, but you can go more extreme, and that is the benefits of writing futuristically. Totally, I mean, I did mention that you can look sometimes a bit stupid in retrospect because you have predicted what is not going to happen, but the benefits is that you can just imagine amazing things and go as far as possible.
Yes, and over there, please.
Holyman, I'm one of the directors of a theatre company called Little Earthquake, based up in Birmingham. I wondered what the panel thought theatre for young children might look like post-Brexit, who are way below voting age to influence what's going on, but are very much living through what's going on, and might maybe want theatre to help them make sense of what they see happening.
Theatre for young people. The Teletubbies do Brexit. Any views on that?
I think you make it bilingual and you make it multinational, and they'll just take it as the way of the world, no matter where the adults have led them or what dodgy path the adults have led them down. Introduce to the children the world that you want, and I think they'll have the intelligence to make that world happen, if not in our lifetime. Certainly in theirs.
Okay, we're just moving towards the big announcement we've been previewing, but I don't like people go home sad not having asked questions, so anyone... There is, yes, over there. We get a... You just keep your hand raised slightly, we'll get the microphone there.
Thank you. Vipan Narang, you've talked a lot about the theatre is the historical voice and it's an important record, and hence why... Irrespective of the audience, it has a reach and an influence. I read a very similar thing about the cinema yesterday, that you're in a confined space as opposed to watching things on Sky or elsewhere with people watching at different times, disparate things, etc., etc. So whilst this is all very important and doing this is very important, if you think about Brexit and why Brexit happened, whether it was people who were left-leaning or right-leaning, a lot of them bought into the lies. A lot of them also sense in their own community things had changed far too much, and they weren't prepared for that change. So I haven't heard too much about those kind of stories. I know that Kwame talked a bit about it, about you understood from the perspective of somebody, I think you said earlier on, a sort of in the States many, many years ago. So how can perhaps yourselves as playwrights put more of that across so the people who did vote for Brexit are more able to understand that there is a different way of looking at this?
Well, that's really what we started with, is whether you were trying to persuade people to change their mind or to reflect the opinions they have.
Oh, God. I don't think I would want to do what you're suggesting. I have my opinions on Brexit, but again, I would want to be okay. Want to convince me, leavers? Why are we doing this? What's the, where are we going to be in 5 to 10 years' time? Tell me. Don't just give me glib answers. But give me concrete stuff for me to process and engage. And then I'll take that away and use that to influence the work that I do, i.e. the writing, and that's all I can do, really.
Kwame?
I think my job as a writer is to be a catalyst for a debate. I have to love everybody on there, and I have to secretly know where I want the debate to go, but be really willing to know that it may not go there, but ultimately catalyze the thing that I think is important. And so in relation to Brexit, whichever way class voted and whichever way, left or right, it's far more important that I find a way through art to articulate that we are living in a borderless world increasingly, and that nationalism actually is relatively self-defeating, and we need to, though it serves many things, but that ultimately I, as a diasporic African, who describes myself as tricultural, African, Caribbean, and British, which is great at the World Cup time. And that being tricultural feeds me, makes me have a greater perspective on the world, gives me a way in, and ultimately, if we're going to be competitive as an economy and as a country, it lies in looking at the world as one and not through the narrow lens of one nationality. My job is to catalyze the debate to take us there.
And now American, so you're quad-cultural now, are you?
No, I'm not American yet.
Sorry, April.
I was just going to say, in a way, you can't write about Brexit, because whatever you write about ostensibly in a play, you're always really writing about something else. And that's just a curious thing about plays, or maybe, that's what people have been talking about metaphor. You could be writing about Brexit, but you could be writing on the surface, but underneath what's really driving the play could be something, or take your pick. Mm.
And on that, just before we hear the announcement, it seems to be important that people are often told, Remainers are often told, look, it's over, it was 52-48. Something looking 10 years ahead, it's deciding where we are at any particular point. I mean, who knows if even individual places are still at the vote they were on the day of the referendum. Well, we don't know, but I mean, that's one of the things. Yeah. But that's something that the plays would have to reflect.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, going back to that whole question about would you write a play about Brexit? I mean, for me, as a playwright, and I think for most people, it's about the characters that you meet. And so, for example, the Ugandan Asian shopkeeper who's complaining about all the Poles that are turning up. That's a great scenario, and it would cause a lot of trouble, and it would be a great play, and it would be about Brexit. So it's that sort of thing where we find different ways of telling that Brexit story, and it's not necessarily just like, hard... we're going to write a play about Brexit. I don't think we think like that, because otherwise then we're just journalists then, we're not playwrights.
And also to just pick up on April's point earlier about Brexit being maybe a symptom, and I know I've fell into the trap of dividing it right and left and da-la-la-la myself, but we also can fall into the trap as though the Leave vote was the vote that was the vote of the lie. Well, actually... I think all of us could feel a sense that things weren't quite right with the status quo, and we're kind of told that hard work is what can define us. Whilst we're seeing rising inequality in food banks, we're being told that at the moment this tyrant is the bad guy. Well, we were kind of selling arms to them not that long ago. The constant lies of the Remain of the establishment. We just maybe have slightly articulated
our frustration with that in a different way than the Leave voter. But I think if we're to address Brexit in this kind of way, it's to see what's behind Brexit, what's at the root of it. And I think what's at the root of it is a kind of alienation from what our lived experience and what we're being told. And yeah.
Thank you very much to Brad Birch, Tanita Gupta, Kwame Kwe-Amar, April De Angelis, James Graham, Roy Williams, and Rosemary Jenkinson. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. There you are. Thank you. So the final part of the evening before the drinks and canapes, I'm going to invite two people to the stage. One is James Dacre, who is Artistic Director of Northampton's Royal and Durngate Theatres, which happens to be my local theatre, in case you think we're all the smug London elite. Smug maybe, but not London necessarily. And I'm going there tomorrow night to see Rules for Living, which I'm looking forward to. And David Gregg, Artistic Director of Edinburgh's The Lyceum, where I was last month. So welcome to stage, please, James Dacre and David Gregg.
I'd like to start by thanking Vicky Hayward for her welcome this evening, and Sir Nicholas Sirota for his introduction, and also to the RSA for hosting tonight's symposium. Many, many huge thanks also, Mark, for chairing tonight's wonderful debate, and to Brad, Tanika, James, April, Roy, Rosemary, and Kwame for such an interesting debate and such wonderful contributions. It's a rare and a wonderful thing to see playwrights on stage, and I'm very, very grateful that all of you have joined us tonight for this symposium. And thank you also to you, the audience, for coming. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's discussion, and that you'll have, as a result of this evening, plenty to think about and reflect upon subsequently. Now, one theme that has very clearly emerged from our discussion tonight is just how uncertain the future is. Mark referenced earlier that famous Chinese curse, "May you live in interesting times." Now, there's no doubt that the next 10 years are going to be very interesting times indeed for Great Britain, Northern Ireland, and Europe. And we at the Royal and Durngate in Northampton, the Royal Lyceum Theatre in Edinburgh, the Lyric Theatre in Belfast, and the Sherman Theatre in Cardiff believe that they'll also make for some pretty interesting theatre also. And that's why we've joined together to embark upon an ambitious project which we've titled Nations on the World Stage. This epic cycle of plays will respond both to Brexit, but more importantly, to the political and the ideological divisions that the referendum has exposed across our country. And we're bringing together a diverse group of emerging and established artists, thinkers, practitioners, and audiences from across Europe to continue the debate on our stages that we began here tonight. So over the next decade, we'll create work which can offer unique insights into our nation's past and our present, but which we hope also will, in their own way, imagine the possibilities for these four nations' future. The details of this commissioning process, and indeed the first commissions, are going to be announced soon. Our vision is that they will be performed in each of the home nations, but also across Europe and beyond, and that ultimately they will be published in an anthology that offers a lasting picture of what England, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales thought about their particular places in the world during this period of monumental change. And so to finish, I'm going to hand it over to David for some concluding remarks.
Thank you very much, James. I just wanted to make some thoughts about why I think plays and theatre are the right place to do this. In 1948, not a stone's throw from this building, a play called Cockpit had its debut by an Anglo-British writer called Bridget Boland. In it, the play begins with two British soldiers guarding a theatre in southern Germany filled with displaced persons and refugees trying to work out where they're going to go next. It's an extraordinary, immersive piece of work that does the bold thing of turning Europe into a metaphor, at least the metaphor being a theatre, the whole of Europe as a theatre. And in 1948, neither Bridget Boland nor the characters in the play knew in which direction Europe might go. We're restaging the play at the Royal Lyceum in a month or so's time, so it's been very much on my mind. And at the read-through, I was immensely moved by this sense that Boland had captured a moment, but in capturing that moment and finding the right metaphor, she offered something to us now, which was to throw up the question of what it took to make the Europe that we have today, and also what potentially we might be losing by departing from it. We live in a time of binaries. If you're Scottish, this is not the only referendum that we've been through recently. We've also had two elections. So in Scotland, there's yes and no. There's leave and remain. There's left and right. And every single combination within of these fractal divisions. In a sense, theatre is the perfect vehicle for us to explore the different identities thrown up within that, because theatre by its nature is multi-perspective. I also think it's important because, as was acknowledged before by the thought of the civic function of art, something happens when political questions are brought into contact with art. The nature of the space changes, the nature of the debate changes from these binaries into something much more fluid, something much more empathic, something much more disrupted. As Roy said, we get to see some of the cracks in between. I think when that's true of art generally, it's even particularly true of theatre and particularly true of the play. Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones was once asked why, you know, whether they were a political band or not. And he said something along the lines of, "Nah, we were never really interested in writing any songs about Ted Heath." I think there's a sense in which all the playwrights tonight have shown that when we think about political theatre, we're not talking about the Michael Gove play or write it. Perhaps now we could write about Ted Heath, actually. I think it will be quite interesting. James, that's one for you. But that sense in which the way the Rolling Stones write a song like Street Fighting Man or Sympathy for the Devil in response to their times, and they capture a moment and they capture a mood, I expect this cycle of plays to find within it moments where it captures the time and the energy of the time. The Lyceum is incredibly excited to collaborate on this project, and I'd like to thank James for getting us all together on behalf of Jimmy Fay at the Lyric and Rachel at the Sherman as well. I think it's worth saying that we're not looking to create plays about Europe. I think it's something different. I think we're looking to create from theatre and from plays a space in which we can discover ourselves and we can discover where we are in relation to the big civic questions of the day. And I'd like to close with my favourite quote from John Lyly, the Elizabethan playwright, who said, "They complain that our plays are all mingle-mangle, but it's not our fault because the whole world has gone hodgepodge." So on that note, and with a suitably European flavour, I'd like from Scotland to salute the Old Alliance and propose that we all venture forth to have a glass of French claret. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.